the wonders of modern technology. Good. One or two of you have come and asked me questions. That's great. Thank you. Keep those up. And a couple of questions have been fed back to me as well, secondhand, which again is great. I'll try to deal with some of those questions in this session and this afternoon session. But if there's anything I haven't covered by the end, do put it in the question box. But as I said, keep asking questions, and I'll try to deal with them in the sessions if that's a more natural place for them. Before I go into the meat of today's session, let me deal with something left over from this morning's session, this first session. How do we deal with people and with churches who don't emphasize the new creation? So what I said this morning is that the new creation is a doctrine as big and as important as some of the doctrines over which we would divide with other churches. So I hope that we would never, ever go to a church which taught that Jesus' death on the cross did not achieve atonement for our sins. We would not engage with them in mission. We would not really consider them Christian if they didn't think that Jesus' death on the cross was what took away God's wrath and what took away our sin, because it is such a big doctrine. If the new creation is such a big doctrine, should we treat people and churches who don't emphasize it the same way? I think the answer to that is no, and let me explain why not. I think because the doctrine of Jesus' death on the cross to atone for sins and take away sins has been around for so long, and people have discussed it and talked about it and engaged with it for so long, that churches that don't emphasize it and reject it are consciously rejecting that doctrine. And that's why we'd want to divide from them. The new creation is a much more recent, well, recent in the sense it's come onto the front of the burner as opposed to being more on the back burner. And therefore, churches often these days, individuals often these days, don't emphasize it, not because they've consciously rejected it, but they just haven't thought about it. And it just wouldn't be right to divide from people who aren't emphasizing it because they've not thought about it. So I think at this stage, it's a doctrine to teach and to explain and to argue for, not a doctrine to divide over, not yet. In the decades to come, it might become so, if I'm right, as I said last night, and becomes a bigger and bigger issue, and Christians and churches begin to consciously reject the doctrine of the new creation, then it's something to divide over, but not when it's just something that people are ignorant over. So hopefully that clarifies that issue a little bit. If you have further questions on that, do shove it in the box. What I want to do, let me explain again what I want to do in this session so you know where we're heading. What I want to do in this session is to look at how the new creation becomes a big issue in the Bible. What I mean by that is what we've seen in the New Testament is that the new creation is a really big deal. It is the place that God's focus is. It's the place that Paul's heart is, that Jesus' kingdom is, that we ought to really want. And there's actually very little about emphasizing this world in the New Testament. So all the people, for example, who want to talk about changing society have to go to the Old Testament. There's nothing in the New Testament on the need to change society. That just isn't the emphasis. But that hasn't always been the case. If you look at the first part of the Bible, in the first part of the Old Testament, there's actually no mention of the new creation at all. None. The emphasis is entirely on this world, entirely on blessings in this world, entirely on changing society in this world. So how has the Bible story moved from the first third of it being virtually entirely this world, to the last quarter of it being virtually entirely being the new creation, with this world as being very different, as we'll see later? How has that shift happened? Let me just explain that a little bit more. If you just think about what you've done in your Bible overview, all the way through the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, all the way through the history of Israel, up to the time of David and Solomon, the emphasis of the history has focused entirely on the land of Canaan. Getting the land of Canaan, threats to life of Israel in the land of Canaan, establishing the monarchy in the land of Canaan as a physical land in this world. But as I said, in the New Testament, it is not so. Now, in the New Testament, in Hebrews 11, that you'll be studying in 2 weeks' time, you'll see that the New Testament says that men of faith, even men like Abraham, very, very early on, they knew that there was a new creation. But it's not explicit. How they knew it, we don't know, but they did discern it. What I'm dealing with in this session is what is explicitly there in the Bible, not with what men of faith might have discerned. It's important to understand how this movement in the story happens, this movement from a focus on this world to a focus on the new creation, because a lot of the confusion among many Christians today about what we should be expecting in this world, much of that confusion arises from not understanding that there's movement. If you don't understand that the story moves forward and evolves and progresses from this world to the new creation, if you don't understand there's movement, then you think you can go to anywhere in the Bible indiscriminately to find out what we should expect of life now, how we should live now, whether we should look at this world or not. And if the whole story is, if you like, flat, with no movement, no progression, then yes, of course, why shouldn't we go to the Old Testament, even the beginning of the Old Testament, to find out how we should live now? We're in the same place. But if there is movement, and if that movement is intentional and not accidental, a real part of God's plan, then everything is different, do you see? You can't go to something early on in the story if God has deliberately and intentionally moved the story on from there. So we need to see that that is the case. That's what I'm going to be trying to get us to see today. And we need to understand it, not just so we can say to other people, you can't go to that part of the Old Testament, the story has moved on, but that so we are comfortable in our own mind that the emphasis now is the new creation, because we really are in a different part of the story. So whether it's so that we're comfortable or whether it's so that we can argue and debate with other people, we need to be clear. The story has moved on. And the story moving on isn't just an accident. It is intentional. It is deliberate. It is absolutely essential, in fact. It is a necessary part of the Bible story that you have a movement from a focus on this world to a focus on the new creation. That movement happens in the second part of the Old Testament. Okay? The part of the Old Testament we don't tend to spend much time on. And we don't spend much time on it because we don't understand it. And because we don't understand it and we don't spend much time there, we don't realize that actually it is crucially important and has moved the story on. As people have done the overview, I'm sure we're all aware that the first part of the Bible story all focuses on Canaan and this land. I'm sure that when I said, as we look at the first part of the story in the Pentateuch, in the history of Israel, it's all in this world, we're all nodding and say, yeah, actually, now I come to think of it, that's right. And we saw this morning, the New Testament is all focused on the new creation. But we probably haven't actually asked ourselves the question, how did that shift happen? I know I didn't until fairly recently ask the question, how did that shift happen? We're probably also aware there are big chunks in the second part of the Old Testament, all the wisdom literature, the prophets, where we don't spend very much time in the Bible overview. And we may not have asked why, what's happening there? Why did God bother putting that in? And realize that actually those two questions are connected. That shift, that movement happens precisely in the bit of the Bible we don't look at. So what I hope this session will do is help us to see how the story moves in the Bible, that there's actually a plot which evolves and develops, and that evolving, developing plot is important. And incidentally, I hope it'll fill in some of the gaps in the overview as we look at into this session now, some of the parts of the Bible that we haven't had a chance to in the overview. The first part happens in what is known as the wisdom literature, which is where, and in the wisdom literature, the question is posed, which is answered later. What is the wisdom literature? The wisdom literature are the books of Job and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon, primarily. The idea of wisdom and the literature associated with it seems to have become a really big deal at around the time of Solomon. Solomon, you may remember, became the wisest man ever when God answered his prayer for wisdom. So let's just have a read of that to get us in the zone. 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 5 to 12. 1 Kings 3, 5 to 12.
At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And you have kept for him this great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David, my father, although I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitudes. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people?" It pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, "Because you have asked this, and have not asked for yourself long life, or riches, or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I will give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall rise after you." Did you say to verse 12?
Yes, please. Yes. Verse 12. Thank you. Brilliant. Thanks, Jesse, very much. So, Solomon prays for wisdom and God and understanding, and God says he'll answer him. And that is really where the topic of wisdom starts seeming to become a big deal in the Bible. Let's just remind ourselves of where we are in the story. This is the height of the monarchy. This is the high point of Israel's history. It's about 500 years after they've come out of Egypt. A lot of the story has happened. In particular, at this point, Israel has got all the land. She's at peace. She's immensely prosperous. She's got everything that God has promised her. If there's any place in the Bible story where it looks like there is fulfillment of the promises in this world, this is it. And so at this point, at the height of Israel in this world, when it looks like the promises are fulfilled in this world, the topic of wisdom comes on the table. And let's have a look at what is said about wisdom at this point. Much of the wisdom literature was written by Solomon or in the time of Solomon. Some seems to have been written earlier, some later. But the height of the monarchy is also the height of wisdom. I want us to focus on two of the wisdom books to see how they'll begin the process of moving the story forward. The other books do something similar, but I'll focus on two of them, which are the clearest, I think, on it. Let's begin with the book of Job. Job is just before Psalms. Psalms are sort of the middle of the Bible, and they're quite big. So go to the middle of the Bible, and the book before that is Job. The book of Job tells us about the story of a righteous man. A man who God is very pleased with, a man who God acknowledges is righteous, a man who God blesses. But though God is pleased with him because he is righteous, and though God blesses him because he is righteous, nevertheless, God allows Satan to tempt him and make him to suffer so that God will be glorified. That's the way the book is set up. Let's have a look at that. Jesse, are you my reader? Fantastic. Wonderful. Could you read Job chapter 1, I'll give you the verses bit by bit because there's so many of them. Let's begin with Job 1:1, please.
"There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil."
Thank you. Blameless and upright. Feared God, turned away from evil. Don't forget that. Can you read chapter 1, verses 6 to 12, please?
"Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord.
Thank you. So God acknowledges that he's completely blameless and perfect, that there's no one else in the world like him, but nevertheless allows Job to tempt him and make him suffer so that God is confident Job will continue to be righteous and God will be more glorified as a result of Job glorifying God even when he suffers. Let's see what happens next in chapter 1, verse 20 to 2, verse 10.
Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, From where have you come? Satan answered the Lord and said, From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Skin for skin. All that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips.
Thank you. So the stakes are upped one more time. Satan takes away all the blessings that Job has, his possessions, his family. They all get destroyed, and still Job trusts God. So Satan says, not enough. Let's make him suffer physically himself. And God continues, says, okay, I'm sure this man will glorify me. Go ahead. And Satan actually makes Job suffer physically terribly, covers his body with horrible sores, and Job still does the right thing. That's the first two chapters. That's the scene set. The rest of the book is then down on earth, and it tells of four people, often called his friends or his comforters, though they're not really very friendly, and they certainly don't comfort him. And they come to Job, and the rest of the book are long conversations between Job and his comforters about his sufferings and why they've happened, as they reflect on Job's sufferings. Now, in order to understand this book, it's really, really important to know that we, the readers, know Job is innocent. We know he's righteous. We know why he's suffering. But none of them do. Job doesn't. The comforters don't. All they can see is the evidence of their eyes. This man is suffering terribly. They don't know what's happening up in heaven. Okay? The comforters argue that God is just. So if Job is suffering, it must be because he sinned. And they do that because, as far as they're concerned, at this point in the story, the world is all that there is. There is nothing apart from this world. There's no afterwards because, as I've said, that hasn't been revealed yet. And the first third of the story has happened. This world is everything. And if this world is everything, if God is just and this man is suffering, the only thing you can deduce is he's righteous. He's sinful. Isn't that right? So that is what the comforters argue. They say, Job, you might look righteous on the outside, but really you aren't. We can't quite figure out where you've sinned, but you've sinned somewhere. because otherwise God wouldn't have made you suffer like this. Job, in response, says, that cannot be right. That absolutely is not right. I am sinless. I know God is just. I know I'm sinless. I don't understand, therefore, why I'm suffering. Something doesn't compute, says Job. Let's just have a look at one example of where he says that. Jesse, can you read Job chapter 10, verses 1 to 9, please?
Job 10, 1 to 9. I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands and favor the designs of the wicked? Have you eyes of flesh? Do you see as man sees? Are your days as the days of man, or your years as a man's years, that you seek out my iniquity and search for my sin, although you know that I'm not guilty, and there's none to deliver out of your hand? Your hands fashioned and made me, and now you have destroyed me altogether. Remember that you have made me like clay, and will you return me to the dust?
Thank you. So Job knows God is in control. He's the one who made, he's the one who rules. Job knows that God is just. Job knows he is innocent. His sufferings, therefore, just do not make sense. It doesn't compute. It's more than that. As part of his argument, Job points out that not only do righteous people like himself suffer for no apparent reason, even worse, the wicked often prosper. Jesse, can you read Job 21, verses 7 to 15?
Mm-hmm. Why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Their offspring are established in their presence, and their descendants before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail, their cow calves and does not miscarry. They send out their little boys like a flock, and their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and the lyre, and rejoice to the sound of the pipe. They spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol. They say to God, depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of your ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him? Behold, is not their prosperity in their hand? The counsel of the wicked is far from me.
Thank you. So, not only do the righteous people suffer when they shouldn't, but wicked people prosper when they shouldn't. Something is seriously wrong. And the reason he realizes, or he thinks that something is seriously wrong, is because as yet, the fact there's anything more than this world has not yet been revealed. If this world is everything, the facts, the evidence of your eyes, and it's still the case today, isn't it? You look around and righteous people suffer, and wicked people prosper. And if this world was everything, you cannot square that with a powerful and just and holy God. It just does not work. You cannot square that circle. Something is wrong, and it's wrong because Job hasn't yet understood that there's more than this world. He's frantically sort of trying to grasp it, and there are little hints, there are one or two verses which sort of half hint that he knows the only resolution to this problem is if this world is not everything. But he doesn't know that. It's not yet been revealed. And so the overwhelming feel of the book is that things don't make sense. In fact, at the heart of the book is a passage where Job bemoans the fact that wisdom, in other words, the answer to his questions, cannot be found in this world. All that God has revealed so far is that people must fear God despite everything. That is the beginning of wisdom. But they can't actually make sense of it. Jesse, can you read Job 28, verses 12 to 28? Key passage at the heart of the book.
But where shall wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels or fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. From where, then, does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and Death say, we have heard a rumor of it with our ears. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding.
Thank you. So wisdom can't be found within the world. It's nowhere. It can't be bought. It's beyond price. There is wisdom. God knows it. But all God has revealed so far is the beginning of wisdom is fear God, keep away from evil, which doesn't actually answer the question, does it, of why do righteous people suffer and why do wicked people prosper? It tells you how you live in the absence of an answer. Fear God, don't be evil, but it doesn't actually answer the question. At the end of the book, God restores Job and vindicates Job and puts right all that was wrong, but never gives him an answer to that question. So you leave the book. The point of the book is that if all we have is this world, we cannot square a just and powerful God with the observation that righteous people sometimes suffer and wicked people often prosper. The answer has not yet been revealed. The problem is even more acute if you realize that this may not be written, this may have been written earlier, but this really seems to have come to the fore at the height of Israel when she's under the Mosaic Covenant. And in the Mosaic Covenant, the focus is entirely in this world's terms, and it says to Israel, if you obey, you will be blessed. If you disobey, you will be cursed. Now, how do you square a promise from God, if you obey, you will be blessed, with Job, who does obey and is not blessed? Or God's revelation in the Mosaic Covenant, if you sin, you will be cursed, with righteous people who sin and say to God, push off, who seem to be blessed? It just doesn't make sense. Something is wrong. You can either close your eyes and pretend all is right, or you can do what Job did, which is have integrity and say, there is a problem. I know God has the answer, but I don't. But there is a problem which has to be solved. And that's what Job does. And so the book is, in many ways, a meditation on the fact that the Mosaic Covenant does not work if this world is all you have. It just raises the question and gets us to think about the fact that therefore there must be something more, some answer somewhere, which we haven't got yet. Let's look at the book of Ecclesiastes, which is another of the wisdom books that explores the same problem from a slightly different angle. Ecclesiastes is slightly more obscure. Go through the Psalms, which is after Job. Go through Proverbs, which is after the Psalms. And Ecclesiastes is the next book after that. Ecclesiastes is written by King of Israel, probably Solomon himself, from a lot of what is said in the book. And the purpose of the book is to argue that if this world is all there is, then most of life is pointless. That's quite a stark statement, isn't it? If this world is all there is, then most of life is pointless. So many of us will know that one of the refrains that runs all the way through Ecclesiastes, if you know anything about the book of Ecclesiastes, you'll know the refrain that runs through it is vanity, vanity, all is vanity. The word vanity basically means it's meaningless, it's pointless. It is transient. It's the word used to describe light mist on a hot summer's day. It's there for a few moments in the morning, the sun comes up, and woof, it's gone. That's what life is. It's all empty, meaningless, pointless, transient. That sounds incredibly depressing, isn't it? But actually, it's a very, very insightful book. And one of the main arguments of the book for why life is pointless. If this world is all there is that in the end, everybody dies. So what is the point of anything? What's the point of being righteous if the righteous and the wise both die? What's the point of being wise if the wise and the foolish both die? What's the point of being rich if the rich and the poor both die? Let's have a look at a couple of passages to just see the way Ecclesiastes makes that point, Solomon makes that point. Jesse, can you read chapter 2, verses 12 to 23, please?
So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. But what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving apart from which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity.
Thank you. And can you read chapter 9, verses 1 to 6 also?
But all this I laid to heart, examining it all. How the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sanctifies and to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As in the good, so is the sinner. And he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun.
Thank you. So Solomon knows it is better to be wise and righteous than foolish and evil. God has revealed that much, but he doesn't know why. Because the righteous, the wise, the evil, the foolish, they all die, and they know nothing. And their memory is forgotten, and it all comes to an end. If this world is all there is, so under the sun is the phrase for this world. Under the sun, in this world, if that's all there is, it's meaningless, it's pointless, it just doesn't make sense. And Solomon doesn't have an answer to this problem either. Like Job, he doesn't have the answer. He's just aware there's a problem if this world is everything. But he doesn't know how to solve it. In passing, he points out that even if one is blessed in this world, it's actually a disappointment. Jesse, can you read chapter 2, verses 1 to 11, please?
I said in my heart, come now, and I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and the pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom. and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of men. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept from my heart no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun.
Thank you. So Solomon, the wisest man, king of all Israel at the height of her prosperity, incredibly rich, who made silver in Jerusalem, we're told, as plentiful as the stones in the ground. You could just chuck it around. It really didn't matter. He's got it all, and he reflects on it, and he says, it's a waste of time. Why did I bother? And it's something that the rich and the famous still say today, don't they? When they're honest, the rich and the famous will say, prosperity and success doesn't bring happiness. And it doesn't. It certainly doesn't bring meaning. So even if you get blessed in this world, it's not worth having. So one of the big messages of the wisdom literature, probably I think the biggest message of the wisdom literature, is that if this world is all there is, we've got a problem. Life is pointless. Much more important, all God's revelation up to this point just doesn't work. You cannot square what God has said with what you can observe. God has said, if you are righteous, you will be blessed, but it doesn't happen. And even if by chance it does happen, it wasn't worth having anyway, so why do you bother? It really doesn't make sense. So you're stuck in the way of the wisdom literature thinking something is seriously wrong with the way this plot is evolving at this point in time. The writers of the wisdom books know this can't be right, but they don't know the answer because it's not been revealed. They appreciate this means there must be something more, but they don't know what it is because God hasn't revealed it. Let's just have a quick look to see that's the case. Ecclesiastes 3, verses 19 to 21, please, Jesse. Don't worry. I'll give everybody else a chance to look up to find it as well. Ecclesiastes 3, 19.
What happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity.
Is there another verse after that, up to 21? 19 to 21. Sorry.
And all go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him?
Thank you. So you see, they don't know. There's a suspicion, there's a question. Do the souls of man go up and the souls of animals go down? They don't know. Who knows? It's not impossible. They're desperately feeling after something, but they don't have the answer. So the question is posed in the wisdom literature. If this world is everything, it doesn't make sense, but it's got to make sense because we know that God is there and we know God is powerful and we know God is just. So there has to be an answer, but where is it? The answer begins to be revealed about 200 years later, 200 years after the time of Solomon, in the prophets, especially in the book of Isaiah, which is probably the most important book in the Old Testament. It is really frequently quoted and alluded to in the New Testament. The more you know Isaiah, the more you see it in most books of the New Testament. It just gets picked up and quoted and alluded to. And you could almost see the New Testament as an exposition of the book of Isaiah. It's full of extremely important things revealed for the first time. Isaiah picks up the story where the wisdom literature leaves it off and points out that there's a major problem with God's plan as it's worked out in this world. His angle on that is that every time God rescues Israel from this world, in this world, it is only temporary. So we know, at this stage in the Bible overview, I'm sure you know, that a constantly recurring feature of the whole of Israel's history is Israel sins, God judges her. Israel repents, God rescues her. You see that all the way through the Bible. You see that very clearly in the book of Judges, which we preached on Sunday evenings fairly recently. But the cycle of sin and judgment, repentance and rescue, actually recurs throughout the Old Testament. Isaiah prophesies over a 50-year period. He's a long prophet. In the kingdom of Judah, at around the time of the Assyrian crisis, when the northern kingdom is destroyed. And in this time, there are two great crises that face the southern kingdom of Judah. First, she is attacked by the northern kingdom of Israel in alliance with Syria. And secondly, a few decades later, she's attacked by Assyria. Shortly after, Assyria has destroyed the northern kingdom. On each occasion, God rescues her. But at the same time as God rescues her, he predicts the next disaster. So the beginning of the book, for your notes, chapter 7, the northern kingdom and Syria have ganged up on Judah. God says, I will stop them, but Assyria is going to come and destroy you. 30-odd years later, chapters around 37, Assyria comes and God says, I will rescue you from her too once she's destroyed the whole land up to Jerusalem, but Babylon will come after that. That's chapter 39. Isaiah then prophesies forward to the Babylonian crisis and says, the Babylonians will come and after that you'll be rescued by the Persians under Cyrus, or the Persians under Cyrus will let you go back. But even that won't be the end. There will be still more disaster because you will continue sinning. So the point of Isaiah is this cycle of sin and judgment and rescue will keep going on and on and on and on because at this point there is no solution. If this world is all there is, if people keep sinning, there is no adequate solution because nothing that can be done, not even God's constant beating of people who sin and rescuing of people who repent, can actually change the fact that people sin. And nothing that God can do from rescuing you from one enemy will stop another enemy from arising. But where Isaiah goes beyond the wisdom literature is that in Isaiah, we begin to find an answer to that problem of no solution within the world. In Isaiah, God reveals there will be a proper solution. There will be a king, for example, on David's throne who will bring everlasting peace, God himself. Jesse, can you read Isaiah chapter 9, verses 2 to 7? We're going to be in Isaiah for a few minutes, so it's worth flipping to that, everybody, so we can follow the readings as Jesse gives them to us. Isaiah chapter 9, verses 2 to 7.
Walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with the joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
Thank you. A great answer to the problem. We will have a king on the throne who will be God himself. That is the first mention in the Bible that this Davidic king will actually be divine, properly divine. But it's more than just a king who's divine. We'll actually have a sacrifice that will actually deal with sin. Chapter 52, verse 13 to 53, verse 6, please, Jesse. 52:13 to 53:6. Again, a passage we know very well, but really important.
Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them they see, and that which they have not heard they understand. Who has believed what they heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. As one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all.
Thank you. So again, a huge solution to a great problem. If a great problem is sin, and that cannot be solved the process of punishment and telling them to be righteous, God will give a sacrifice that will actually deal with it. But at the same time as God says there is an actual problem, a solution to the problem of sin, God himself will come and be a sacrifice to take away the sins of the world. At the same time, he reveals for the first time that he will make a very different sort of world, a world in particular where death is defeated. Chapter 25, give us a chance to look that up, Jesse, before you read it, please. Chapter 25, verses 6 to 8, very important. It's the first mention in the Bible of death being defeated, that there is something after death. To eight. Yes, please.
On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever, and the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth. For the Lord has spoken.
Thank you. And it's not just his defeat at death. It's even more explicit. There's actually life after death. Can you just read the next chapter, chapter 26, verse 19, which again I think is the first mention of resurrection in the Bible.
Your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy. For your dew is a dew of light, and the earth will give birth to the dead.
Thank you. And he won't just raise people from the dead. At the same time, he will establish a wonderful new creation in which the problems of this fallen world will be properly dealt with. We read it before the break, but it's so important. I want us to look at it again. Chapter 65, verses 17 to 25. So again, let me remind us, this is the first mention in the Bible of a new creation. Please, to the end of the chapter.
For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain, or bear children for calamity. For they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer, and while they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord.
Thank you. So the problems that spoil this world will be fully dealt with. There will be a huge solution to the huge problem. God alone can accomplish it, but God alone will do it. So the problem of this endless cycle of sin and judgment and rescue, which means that God's promise of a permanent land and permanent blessings for his people just can't be fulfilled. It's all dealt with by God coming and doing an amazing new thing. But the amazing new thing that God is doing is new creation and life after death. There is no solution within this world order for the problems that we have been seeing. But that is not a problem for God. The God who made this world will make another one in which the problems don't exist. And that endless cycle of sin and judgment and rescue and sin and judgment and rescue will be ended, and his people will have perfect peace and blessing. And in a stroke, can you see how all the other problems associated with the wisdom literature, raised in the wisdom literature, are also dealt with? So the apparent lack of justice, where righteous people suffer and wicked people prosper in this world, all that goes away because there is a judgment later on which determines who gets into the new creation and who doesn't. And Isaiah makes that explicit, that the wicked won't inherit God's new creation. Atonement for sin is not for everyone. It's only for some, the humble and the contrite. So let's look at chapter 66. Jesse, can you read verses 1 to 2, please?
Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you would build for me, and what is the place of my rest? All these things my hand has made, and so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. But this is the one to whom I will look, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word.
Thank you. So that's who God is looking for. Look at the very end, the last few verses of the book, chapter 66, verses 22 to 24. The note the book ends on, 22 to 24.
For as the new heavens and the new earth that I make shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your offspring and your name remain. From new moon to new moon, and from Sabbath to Sabbath, all flesh shall come to worship before me, declares the Lord.
Keep going to the end.
And they shall go out and look on the dead bodies of the men who have rebelled against me. For their worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh.
Thank you. Now, if you don't understand what's happening, that last verse, you just think that's a very odd negative note to end on. I'd rather end a bit before that, when it sounds good. They live in the new heavens and the new earth and all is brilliant. But do you see how that last verse actually answers the problem? There's a point in how you live now, because not everybody is there. There is a final judgment where some people, the humble and the contrite of verses 1 and 2, are in the new creation. But the wicked, they're not. They're punished. They're outside forever. So life in this world is not pointless if death doesn't end everything. If there's life after death, in which blessings can truly satisfy, in which justice is truly done, in which the problems of this world are resolved, then everything gains meaning again. And that is the case, says Isaiah. God reveals there will be life after death. There will be a new creation. There will be justice. You only think there's a problem because you think this world is everything. Look beyond it, and it's not. And that's why Isaiah is probably the most important book in the Old Testament and quoted so much in the New. Let me sum up as we wind up. Until the time of David and Solomon, this is by way of recap, until the time of David and Solomon, it looks like this world is all there is. But if that is the case, then what God has revealed up to that point seems inconsistent with the facts, and his promises don't seem to be being fulfilled. In the wisdom literature, God reveals this problem clearly and gets Israel to think about the problem so she realizes there must be something more. But he doesn't reveal what that is yet. 200 years later, as the prophets begin to prophesy, God begins to reveal the answer. There will be a new creation where all his promises can actually be fulfilled, and the promises of the fall, and the problems of the fall can actually be dealt with properly. There is life after death where justice will be done. So can you see that the new creation is not just an incidental add-on to the story? The new creation is essential to solve the problem which cannot be solved within this world, which is the apparent lack of justice, the apparent futility of life, the apparent meaninglessness even when you get the things you think you want. Only God can do it, but it is essential to the fulfillment of his plan to reverse the fall. It's essential to God being just. It's essential to God's word being true. Without the new creation, God has lied in his word because it hasn't come about. God can't be just because the wicked prosper, and his plan isn't fulfilled. The new creation is absolutely crucial to the fulfillment of all God is doing. And it's clear, even at this stage, that that focus on the new creation is essential because this world doesn't work means that God's focus is not this world. It doesn't work here. That becomes even more explicit in the New Testament, but hopefully it's begun to become pretty clear even by now that in this world it is futile and pointless. Let me just add one quick caveat as we finish, because if you haven't started thinking about this, you will quite soon. You certainly should be. Which is, does that mean that God made a mistake initially? In focusing on this world up to the point of Solomon, etc., was that a mistake? Plan A, whoops, it didn't work when they got to Solomon. We need plan B now. No, obviously not, but let me just explain why not. The whole Bible story has shifts. Things which looked as though they happened one way in the Old Testament happen another way when you get to the New. So in the Old Testament, it looks like the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, the Hebrews, are God's people. We know in the New Testament that's not the case. It's Christians from every nation, race, tribe, including the Jews, but not all the Jews, and certainly not restricted to the Jews. The same is true of this area. God has not made a mistake. He's just moved the plot forward. And the reason for that is because God reveals things initially in categories that fallen human beings can understand. And once they've understood that, he then reveals the next step, the thing he's really doing. So he wants to reveal initially that he's rescuing people. So he rescues Israel from Egypt for the promised land of Canaan. If he said initially, right up front, Genesis 1, I'm rescuing you for heaven, new creation. Everybody says, don't understand rescue, don't understand new creation. This is pointless. Forget it. So he shows them in real time what is happening. Look, I'm rescuing you. You sin, I'm punishing you. And when after a few hundred years they begin to get it, he said, okay, now you've got the idea of rescue. Let me tell you what the rescue is really for. Next step. Does that make sense? He does that with all sorts of things. As I've said, he does it with the people he rescues, not Israel, but Christians. He does it with things like the sacrificial system. Initially, you see animals killed. And when you twig, death of animal means sin may be taken away. He says, but that wasn't enough. We need actually a person, sinless person, my son. But if Jesus had come right at the beginning, before animal sacrifices had been revealed, everybody would have thought, why does somebody need to die? Doesn't make sense. But once you twig sacrifice is necessary, you can then say, but you need a good sacrifice. Similarly, priesthood. You get priests from the line of Levi in the Old Testament. You get Jesus, who is a high priest, but not from the line of Levi, a different priest doing a different thing. In area after area, the story moves from the Old Testament as you move to the New, because God first reveals something so you get a principle, Then he uses that and says, but the real thing I'm doing is. So in the Old Testament, you get sort of all sorts of obscure laws about leprosy. If you're leprous, you're thrown out of the camp. We don't do that these days, because leprosy was just to show you that if you're tainted, you can't be within God's people. But the taint that matters, says the New Testament, is not the external on the skin, it's the internal in the heart of sin. But until you get the idea that tainted, unclean people can't be in God's people, he can't reveal that the thing he's really concerned about is the unseen taint, the unseen corruption within the heart. Does that make sense? So you first get the principle from what is seen, and then he says, now what I'm doing is the unseen. It's true of sin, it's true of sacrifice, it's true of priesthood, it's true of the people, it's true of the shift from this world to the new creation. God didn't make a mistake in focusing initially on this world. He was teaching lessons. And once we got that, he then says, but it doesn't work quite if we just stay here, do we? So the next lesson is, there is a new creation. So that's the way the story moves. I'm going to draw stumps there. We're going to go away into groups now, I think, to discuss some things, and I'll hand back to Roger.